Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 213. It's Monday, May 29th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's get right to it and let's talk about gun violence. Here's a new poll that gives us a little bit of info on where we stand today in America with guns and gun violence. This from NPR. Poll says most Americans say curbing gun violence is more important than gun rights. The highest percentage of Americans in a decade say they think it's more important to curb gun violence than protect gun rights, according to a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll. But the survey of almost 1,300 adults also shows Americans' views on guns are mixed, with little consensus on what to do about gun violence. Fewer Americans say they feel their community schools are safe from gun violence. And while a significant majority feel the answer to mass shootings is stricter gun laws, the percentage believing the solution is more people needing to carry guns has jumped 10 points in the last 4 years. 6 in 10 say controlling gun violence is more important than protecting gun rights. That's the highest in 10 years and includes 4 in 10 gun owners. In 2013, people were split on this, but Democrats and many independents have shifted since. 2/3 of Republicans, however, side with protecting gun rights. 57% say schools in their community are safe, but since 2019, that's down 8 points. They say their local schools, those saying their local schools are not safe, has jumped 10 points. This is driven by Democrats, who are split on whether schools are safe. Republicans at 69% and independents at 58% largely still feel their community schools are safe. There are wide divisions on semi-automatic assault-style weapons like the AR-15. For Democrats, banning these kinds of weapons was their top choice for what could reduce gun violence. 44% of Democrats said so. But only 13% of Republicans did. That discrepancy was the widest of all the options tested in this survey, which include mental health screenings for all gun buyers, background checks at gun shows and private sales, red flag laws, and allowing teachers to carry guns in classrooms. Overall, 27% said banning assault-style guns would have the biggest impact, followed by mental health screenings, purchases at gun shows and private sales, and red flag laws. For Republicans, though, it was mental health screenings they believed would have the most impact, followed by arming teachers in schools. Oh my goodness. Notably, the older people are, the more likely are they to say that this type of ban would help. 37% of those 60-year-old are listed as first, followed by 29% of 45 to 59-year-olds, 23% of 30 to 44-year-olds, and 15% of 18 to 29-year-olds. A significant portion, one in five of the population, though, doesn't think anything will work. More than 6 in 10 say their first reaction when they hear about mass shootings is that they need to be stricter gun laws. But those saying people need to carry guns has also gone up by 10 points in 2019, from 25% to 35%. A majority support stand your ground laws. A significant majority at 58% said they support these kinds of laws that allow people who are in public places and believe that their life or safety is in danger to kill or injure the person who they think is threatening them. This includes 81% of Republicans, 57% of Democrats, and 57% of independents and 40% of Democrats. Non-whites and those in states with more lax gun laws are more likely to experience gun violence. Overall, 41% said they or someone they know has experienced gun violence, for example, being threatened with a gun or as a victim of a shooting. Non-whites were 10 points more likely than whites to experience gun violence or know someone who has. People in states with more lax gun laws were also 8 points more likely to say they or someone they know has experienced gun violence, 45% to 37%. Well, there's a lot there, although as I moaned at the stand your ground laws with 58% support among the American public, I know that's emotionally hard to avoid the idea that if you're in a situation that might be dangerous, that you want to have a gun to protect yourselves. But as a public policy and a public health perspective, it's very dangerous, only adds more danger to the situation. And interestingly, unarmed bystanders are more likely to stop a shooting than armed shooters. Of course, maybe those people who think that we just don't have enough people that are armed. But in both the home and in public, having a gun around leads to more death. And in this country, we still have tens of thousands of people killing themselves with guns and tens of thousands of people killing others with guns every single year. And as a gentle reminder, when we're talking about gun violence prevention, actually more people kill themselves with guns than they kill other people. So suicide is a big factor in gun violence deaths. And this article gets to a bit about that with Medical Express. Most Americans don't know what 988 Suicide Crisis Hotline is for, poll shows. Only 13% of American adults understood the purpose of the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, nearly a year after its widely publicized launch, a new survey from Pew Charitable Trust shows. A 988 line began last year after it was changed from 1-800-273-TALK. It was previously called the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Pew surveyed more than 5,000 adults in April, finding that once people knew about the 988 crisis line, about 7 in 10 said they were somewhat or highly likely to use it. Respondents also had some concerns about where calling the line might lead. About 2 of 5 of those surveyed worried that calling 988 would lead to police arriving at their home, being forced to go to the hospital, being charged for services they couldn't afford, or having other people learn about the call. Race played a part in the results. Twice as many white people as black people were aware of the 988 line. College-educated respondents were more aware of the line than those with a high school degree or less. Call volume has increased in the past year, with 160,000 more calls, chats, and texts in April 2023 than the previous April, which were also answered more quickly than with the previous hotline. Calls increased 52%, chats increased 90%, and texts increased over 1,000%, CNN reported. So, if you are suicidal or in a mental health crisis, calling 988 is one way to get help. Okay, next up, a bit of good news and bad news. This from MedPage Today. Uninsured rate hits record low of 8.3%. The uninsured rate in the U.S. has fallen to a record low 8.3%, but that percentage is expected to gradually increase as insurance protections from the COVID-19 pandemic wind down, according to officials from the Congressional Budget Office. The Congressional Budget Office is projecting an uninsured rate of 10.1% by 2033, and while that's obviously higher than the 8.3% that we're estimating for 2023, it is nevertheless lower than the uninsured rate in the last year prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, which was about 12%. In total, 15.5 million people will be transitioning out of Medicaid after eligibility redetermination. Among that 15.5 million people, the Congressional Budget Office is estimating that 6.2 million of them will go uninsured, and the remainder will be enrolled in another source of coverage, such as individual coverage or employment-based coverage. So it looks like we've peaked at the amount of insurance, at least for the time being. Okay, well, in some good news and progress in public health, this from Roll Call. CDC says HIV declines driven by teens and young adults. New HIV infections dropped 12% in 2021 compared to 2017, according to a new CDC estimate released last Tuesday, with the biggest drops among young gay and bisexual men. But the agency warned that HIV prevention efforts need to be accelerated to reach the national goals. The data release credited the overall decrease to a 34% drop in infections among 13 to 24-year-olds, with the largest declines among young gay and bisexual men. Annual HIV infections among young people decrease from 9,300 to 6,100, but among LGBTQ men, new infections drop from 7,400 to 4,900. Reductions in new infections were not uniform against racial and ethnic groups. The CDC estimated a 45% drop in new infections among young LGBTQ white males compared to a smaller 36% drop in young Hispanic Latino LGBTQ males, and only a 27% drop among young LGBTQ black males. CDC credited factors like more widespread access to HIV testing, treatment, and pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, to reductions in new infections, but acknowledged other factors may limit availability to these tools among black and Hispanic or Latino individuals. The use of PrEP, a medication taken to reduce the risk of contracting HIV, grew, with 30% of the recommended population getting a prescription for the drug, up from 13% in 2017. In 2021, an estimated 1.2 million people would have benefited from the drug. PrEP uptake was highest among white individuals 16 and up at about 78%, compared to about 11% among blacks and 21% in Hispanic Latino individuals 16 and up. In prevention, patience is not a virtue, said Jonathan Merman, director of CDC's National Center for HIV, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. Decreasing HIV incidence among youth, including young gay and bisexual males, shows us what is possible. But ending the HIV epidemic and achieving equity requires we expand this progress to all. CDC, in releasing the new data, called for increasing investments in the Ending the HIV Epidemic Plan, expanding how and where individuals could access HIV testing, and ensuring HIV prevention efforts are more equitable. The White House budget request released in March seeks $850 million for the plan, or 48% over enacted levels. It also proposes reducing barriers to access PrEP through Medicaid and to make PrEP free for uninsured and underinsured individuals. The proposed national PrEP program would cost $237 million in fiscal year 2024. Carl Schmid, executive director of the HIV and Hepatitis Policy Institute, praised the positive progress from the new data, but said the documented discrepancies underscore the need for increased funding for HIV/AIDS and a national PrEP program. Both Presidents Trump and Biden have put forth initiatives to end HIV with calls for increased funding for testing, treatment, and prevention, including for PrEP. However, it is necessary for Congress to commit to the investments as well, said Schmidt. While there have been some increases, they have not been at the level needed to put the U.S. on the path to end HIV. This will result in new infections, more people living with HIV, and the need to provide lifetime care and treatment. He also called on CDC to increase accountability for state grantees so that existing HIV prevention resources are better targeted to communities facing disparities. Okay, next up, White House launches national plan to end gender-based violence. This is from CNN. The U.S. National Plan to End Gender-Based Violence, released last Thursday, includes seven pillars under which the Biden administration aims to focus its efforts, including providing support for survivors of gender-based violence, addressing online harassment and abuse, and conducting more robust research, as well as collecting additional data on gender-based violence. Within each pillar, there are overarching goals and objectives for the administration to work toward in its effort to prevent this type of violence nationally and abroad. Our hope is that the plan will also be useful to local and state governments, as well as community organizations across the U.S., to guide and support their efforts to end gender-based violence, Jennifer Klein, Assistant to the President and Director of the White House Gender Policy Council, said in a statement. In 2021, President Joe Biden signed an executive order to establish the White House Gender Policy Council, and he called on the council to develop a national strategy on gender equity and equality, including the commitment to ending gender-based violence both domestically and globally. Separately, last year, the Violence Against Women Act, aimed at protecting and supporting survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking, was renewed, marking a years-long effort to modernize the landmark legislation after it expired in 2018. Biden had helped write the original piece of legislation that was enacted in 1994 when he was a senator from Delaware. About 80 countries around the world have national action plans, and the United Nations considers it a promising practice in the global commitment to end gender-based violence, a senior administration official said. It's estimated that about 1 in 3 women worldwide have been subjected to either physical or sexual violence in their lifetime, according to the World Health Organization. We are excited for the first time to be able to share the U.S. plan, both domestically but also share it globally with other countries around the world. Gender-based violence is a public safety and a public health crisis here and around the world, experienced by individuals of all backgrounds. The National Network to End Domestic Violence praised the launch of the White House's National Action Plan, calling it groundbreaking and saying that it is being launched at a time when survivors' needs are at an all-time high and are outpacing the capacity of domestic violence shelters. Now, there is a world to shoot for, a world without gender-based violence or any violence. Okay, next up, another story related to women's health and disparities, this from The Hill. The National Institutes of Health must address disparities in women's health research funding. It was 30 years ago in the National Institutes of Health Revitalization Act of 1993 that Congress mandated that the NIH include women and minorities as participants in clinical trials. Notably, there should be enough women and minorities sufficient to provide for valid analyses of whether the variables being studied in the trial affect women or members of minority groups, as the case may be, differently than other subjects in the trial. The hope was that by doing so, scientific research would better reflect and understand how males and females function biologically and how they differed with respect to medical conditions. This transformation did not happen, though, as science did not change its belief that women are the same as men, except for our reproductive capabilities. Through continuous advocacy and research discoveries, it was finally determined that it mattered. The NIH recognized the full importance of sex as a basic variable to research in 2016, implementing a new NIH-wide policy that required a basic variable to be factored that required sex as a basic variable to be factored into research designs, analyses, and reporting in vertebrate animal and human studies. Strong justification from the scientific literature, preliminary data, and other relevant considerations must be provided for applications proposing to study only one sex. We have long known that biological sex, whether or not you were born with XY or XX chromosomes, makes an enormous difference in our lives, from our gene expression to our hormones, organ function, and what organs we have, that is reproductive, how we metabolize drugs, our behaviors, what diseases we are most susceptible to, and how serious they are, and more. Here's just a sample of how that plays out, according to a report by the nonprofit Women's Health Access Matters, WHAM. Nearly 40 million American women have an autoimmune disorder, like arthritis, accounting for 78% of all those who suffer from these conditions. Women are 50% more likely than men to die in the year after a heart attack. They are 66% of all Alzheimer's patients, and non-smoking women are twice as likely to get lung cancer than non-smoking men. 1 in 5 women, compared to 1 in 16 men, suffer from migraine disease. Women are twice as likely as men to be diagnosed with some form of depression. Of the 10 million Americans with osteoporosis, 8 million are women. And certain cancers like breast and ovarian, of course, almost exclusively affect women. Women also experience unique health conditions related to puberty, pregnancy, childbirth, and menopause. Despite the NIH requirements on sex as a basic variable, it is not clear how well this is enforced, nor is the evidence showing up in published papers. The major medical journals, the New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of the American Medical Association, Journal of Public Health, and others, do not have a requirement that these analyses be included in the published works on trials using females and males. This is a major loss in scientific advancement and understanding of sex differences that would benefit the health of women as well as men. According to a 2021 study in the Journal of Women's Health, there are roughly 3 times as many diseases whose funding pattern favors males. The disease affects mainly women and is underfunded, or affects mainly men and is overfunded, as there are diseases whose funding patterns favor females. It also shows that the degree of funding bias for diseases that favors males is roughly twice as great as that for diseases that favor males. This inequity has serious economic implications for a nation. In fact, WHAM found that investing $350 million into women's health research generates $14 billion for our economy. Overall, they discovered that such investments yield greater returns than investments in general research. Take, for example, 3 areas that disproportionately impact women: Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, coronary artery disease, and rheumatoid arthritis. If current NIH funding was doubled for research into these illnesses, the aggregate cost savings to society over 30 years would be $932 million, $1.9 billion, and $10.5 billion for each condition, respectively. So what gives? These disparities can't be allowed to persist. It is past time for the NIH to focus on the power of its purse on the burden of disease more fairly. If we are serious about women's health this month, which happens to be Women's Health Month, and really, women's health all the time, the NIH must start funding medical research more equitably. The reason is simple. Millions of lives depend on it. Okay, well, next up, I have a story on primary care and how it can be improved in the United States. Of course, primary care would be your family physician or internist, OBGYN, who takes care and coordinates your basic health care and is kind of the foundation of a well-operating healthcare system. So this from MedPage Today. How can primary care be improved in the U.S.? Are you taking Fridays off at your medical practice? If so, you're not alone, said Ashani Ganguly, MD, a primary care physician at Harvard's Medical School in Boston, at a primary care forum last Thursday. We see this 20% dip in office visits on Fridays, specialist visits more than primary care visits, Ganguly said at the event sponsored by the American Academy of Family Physicians. There's also a drop in people coming in to have procedures, lab work, or imaging tests on Fridays. It's fascinating because it shows that we've designed care around the clinicians. I would bet that patients prefer to have some procedures on Fridays so they recover over the weekend, but we're not seeing that. So measuring this may be one step towards centering ourselves more around our patients. One problem for physicians who want to add weekend or evening hours to their practices is that the majority of physicians are employed now rather than running their own practices, said Darrellyn Moyer, Executive Vice President and CEO of the American College of Physicians. And even though they know that's the right thing to do, they do not have the power at the organization. So I think the message is that the payers and the credentialers and licensors of these organizations need to have more specific rules around funding these important initiatives. Cameron Matthews, Chief Health Officer of CityBlock Health, said that one of her best experiences with a health provider was with a dental practice in Chicago, which had 7 days a week, 12 hours a day of scheduled appointments, even on Saturdays and Sundays. The fact that we are still fighting a lot of practices to have evening hours, even to 7 p.m. or Saturdays hours, is unfortunate. For the 18 to 64-year-olds, for the working population, and definitely for the underserved population that do not have the ability to take leave and often also have transportation difficulties, the appointment alone is not just the inconvenience. It's also the arrival and departure time and the child care and the like. We need to think about how we say that we're patient-centered, but we're clearly not. The current state of primary care is, quote, fragile and weakening, said Chris Kohler, president of the Milbank Memorial Fund in New York City. He highlighted conclusions from the fund's report on the health of U.S. primary care, which came out earlier in February. Payment and investment. We spend less money on primary care as a portion of our total expenses than any other country, said Kohler. Over the past 10 years, that investment has stayed flat or gone down across all payers, Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial. Access. Kohler noted that patients who have a usual source of care, regardless of what it is, have fewer visits to the emergency room, improved health, and better chronic care management. However, in the U.S. in the last 10 years, the number of people not reporting a usual source of care has gone from 22% to 29%. The increase is happening across all types of payers, so it's not just a high deductible issue, and this is happening in a period when insurance access is increasing. Another part of access is physician and clinician supply, and we found that enormous variation across the country around the number of primary care clinicians and nurse practitioners and physician assistants per capita, and that variation is increasing over time. The regions and communities that are medically underserved areas, health professional shortage areas, these are experiencing greater gaps compared to the rest of the country. Workforce training. The numbers here are really simple. In 2010, 1 out of 3 doctors were in primary care. But in 2020, our schools are producing 1 out of every 5. So we're not replacing clinicians who are retiring. And we are training our primary care clinicians on the coast and in hospital settings, rather than in communities in teams. So frankly, our medical education system is failing in terms of giving us the clinicians that we want. Research. Although people may think that spending only 6% of U.S. healthcare dollars on primary care is low, keep in mind that the portion of research money that goes to primary care is 0.2%, said Kohler. So 6% is bad enough, but in terms of where our priorities are, where we want to learn, where we want to grow, we're putting nothing into primary care. Even when medical students receive training in primary care, it may not be the best quality. Anecdotally, the medical students that I work with regularly through both nonprofit as well as past academic experiences are also really speaking about the lack of quality to the primary care training that they are receiving. That includes extremely negative experiences with the faculty, usually adjunct if it's even community-based. The very negative experiences that they're having with these connections where they automatically step away from their primary care rotations in medical school and say, there's no way, I would never want that. So the screening by medical schools of what adjunct faculty they're using, the accountability there, I think needs to be addressed. Although primary care physicians can't be expected to fix everything wrong with the U.S. healthcare system, I'd like to see a payment model that would allow them to fix more problems than they currently can, said Fritz Bush, principal and consulting actuary with the Milliman Consulting Group, which sponsored the forum. For example, although the average office visit is 7 minutes long, I don't know of any competent professional who could execute their core competency in 7 minutes. The key element is time. I must admit, if you had asked me that, I probably would have guessed something on the order of 10 minutes. But 7 minutes, I mean, this is frighteningly low and just shows you what kind of production line that, in this case, primary care clinicians are really being forced to run by only allowing 7 minutes for each patient. Yikes. Okay, well, next up, I want to go a little bit bigger and do a couple articles about how America is failing blacks in this country with the huge racial ethnic disparities in health, which are very persistent. First up, from Stat News, we're failing to make progress. Studies show ongoing toll of premature black deaths. In the last 2 decades, black Americans have suffered 1.63 million excess deaths and lost more than 80 million years of life compared to white Americans, according to a new analysis that is the first comprehensive attempt to quantify the impact of health disparities by tallying years of potential life loss. The analysis shows improvement was made in narrowing longstanding health gaps between black and white Americans between 1999 and 2011, but progress stalled through 2019. The COVID pandemic, which disproportionately killed people who are black, Hispanic, Native American, and Pacific Islander, then rapidly increased the number of excess deaths in black populations. Despite billions of dollars flowing into healthcare and a lot of rhetoric about health equity, we're failing to make progress, said Harlan Krumholtz, a cardiologist and professor of medicine at Yale, who directs the University's Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation and was the study's senior author. It's not understood as a national emergency, unless you're listening to this show. For years, veteran health equity scholar David Williams has likened the toll of premature black deaths to a fully loaded jumbo jet falling out of the sky each day and questioned why more has not been done. The new study similarly illuminates the depressing calculus of health disparities. It's grandmothers, fathers, loved ones, children, said Krumholtz. We need to think about all these empty chairs at the dinner table. It's a staggering loss. A separate paper in the same issue of JAMA estimated that the economic burden of health disparities on non-white racial and ethnic groups in America in 2018 was more than $400 billion. The number revises upward previous estimates of the cost of health disparities from $309 billion in 2006 and $320 billion in 2014. 70% of that cost was borne by black Americans, a study found, with two-thirds of the burden attributable to premature death and the rest due to medical care costs and lost labor productivity. The new analysis on excess deaths rebuts those who dismiss the heavy loss of life in black communities as being due predominantly to crime, accidents, or firearm injury. A lot of it is traditional causes like heart disease and cancer. The author said their work also made clear that there are no underlying biological mechanisms to explain racial differences in life expectancy. They said the early deaths were due to other factors linked to race, such as access to healthy food, stable housing, quality health care, and economic opportunity. Investing in these is simply a smart strategy to improve the health of all residents, Marcella Nunez Smith, a physician, associate dean of health equity research at the Yale School of Medicine, and study author told Stat. We do fundamentally know what communities need to be healthy. Krumholtz said investments in tackling structural racism in medicine were as critical as those made in the fight against cancer. It's an enormous opportunity to save lives, he said. The whole study The study found nearly a million excess deaths occurred in black males between 1999 and 2020, with more than 600,000 occurring in black females. The excess mortality rate among the black males declined from 400 to 201 deaths per 100,000 between 1999 and 2011, plateaued between 2011 and 2019, and jumped to 395 in 2020 during the coronavirus pandemic. For black females, excess deaths declined from 224 per 100,000 in 1999 to 87 in 2015, and then rose to 2020 to 192 deaths. The analysis found the brunt of excess deaths in black communities was due to the loss of infants and older Americans, and that a leading cause of excess mortality, in addition to heart disease and cancer, was infant mortality. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Health, School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, another story that relates to that, the second in this little series here, from Medical Express. Study finds that eight factors put black adults at greater risk of early death. And this is really to accentuate the reality that we look at often individual risk factors, you know, for health, but these are really large social determinants that account for the difference in racial ethnic health disparities. Black adults who live in the United States have a 59% higher risk of premature death than white adults. A new study from Tulane University published in Lancet Public Health has found that this gap can be entirely explained by disparities in eight areas of life critical to health and well-being: employment, income, food security, educational level, access to health care, quality health insurance, home ownership, and marital status. These eight factors are called social determinants of health. Using data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, a CDC survey used to determine disease prevalence and risk across the country, Tulane researchers modeled the impact of each factor on a person's life expectancy. When all unfavorable social determinants were accounted for, the 59% mortality disparity was reduced to zero. It totally disappeared, said Josh Bundy, lead author and epidemiologist at Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. There's no difference between black and white premature mortality rates after accounting for these social determinants. When the mortality gap has been largely pinned on socioeconomic factors such as education level, income, and employment status in recent years, researchers have acknowledged that these factors only explain most of the gap, Bundy said. This is the first time that anyone completely explained the differences, Bundy said. We didn't expect that. We were excited about the finding because it suggests social determinants should be the primary targets for eliminating health disparities. Socioeconomic factors were still found to play a major role, accounting for approximately 50% of the black-white difference in mortality in the study. However, the other nearly 50% of the difference was explained by marital status, food security, and whether someone has public or private health insurance, softer indicators that can speak to a person's social support network, stability, or job quality. Unfavorable social determinants of health were more common among black adults and were found to carry enormous risk. Having just one unfavorable social determinant of health was found to double a person's chance of an early death. With six or more, a person has eight times higher risk of premature mortality. Zhang He, the corresponding author and chair of epidemiology at the School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine of Tulane, said that results demonstrated that race-based health disparities are social, not biological constructs. Bundy agreed, adding that the findings explain how structural racism and discrimination lead to worse social risk factors, which may lead to premature death. So how do we eliminate the structural differences between races, Bundy said? And regardless of race, if you have six or more of these factors, you're at a really high risk. How do we address these issues for everyone? As a concept, social determinants of health is a relatively new framework being emphasized by the CDC's Healthy People 2030 initiative. That's the goals and objectives for health for the entire nation. Going forward, Bundy hopes the concept gains more traction and that policymakers use these findings to address the race-based mortality gap. These social determinants of health are the foundation of health problems, Bundy said. They need to be a top priority going forward, and it's going to take policy, research, and a multidisciplinary approach to tackle these issues. Sum all that together, and what do you get? Racism kills. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears and do a little bit of a different story. This is an in-depth story about something that's a particular interest and a little bit of a pet peeve of mine in the world is noise pollution. And this one's specifically targeted on children. Children need quiet environments to help early brain development. This is from NPR. And of course, it'll get to the point that this is obviously important for adults too, but is critically important for kids. How a little more silence in children's lives helps them grow. A group of small children sits cross-legged with their teacher, Stephen Maya Menendez, on a round carpet. He's a pre-K teacher at Lee Montessori Public Charter School's campus in Southeast Washington, D.C. And although I'm here to meet him, I almost don't spot him because he's eye level with his students. Mr. Steve, as he's known here, is talking to a few students through a geometry lesson when another student approaches to ask an unrelated question. This kind of distraction happens all the time in classrooms around the United States. Mr. Steve doesn't lose focus. He uses American Sign Language to say, "Wait," palms facing up, fingers wiggling, and the child waits patiently. When the lesson arrives at a natural stopping point, the student is invited to ask his question, and Mr. Steve silently responds by nodding his head along with his fist, which is a sign language for yes. Blink, and you could miss the whole interaction. This isn't a school for students with hearing disabilities, but Mr. Steve uses American Sign Language as part of the broader approach to minimize noise in the classroom, and it's noticeably quiet. No one is talking louder than what's often referred to in Montessori schools as the hum. Silence is a kind of peak achievement in a child's ability to control themselves. We create the conditions for children to concentrate. Unlike this classroom, the city outside is full of noise, and studies show that too much noise, particularly loud noise, can hurt a child's cognitive development, notably for language-based skills such as reading. That's because if noise is just, well, noise, it distracts developing brains and makes it more difficult for children to concentrate. But when their environment is quiet enough for them to pay attention to sounds that are important or particularly interesting to them, it is a powerful teaching tool. Young children's brains are craving sound-to-meaning connections, so it's very important that the sounds around them be nourishing and meaningful, said Nina Krause, a neurobiologist at Northwestern University. She believes turning down the noise in our lives starts with embracing, even enjoying, silence. Silence is difficult to find and create, for kids and adults alike. Around the world, fans of silence have begun to catalog the world's disappearing quiet places. But Lee Montessori in Washington, D.C., a city that is a surround sound cacophony. Busy highways, screeching commuter trains, jarring car horns, waterways with the blare of boat whistles, and the seemingly constant whir of presidential and military helicopters and the drone of commercial airplanes. But teachers do what they can. Inside the Bright Elementary School, there are no disruptive public address announcements. Students even wear special classroom shoes made of cloth and soft rubber soles. The hearing brain is vast, Krauss, the neurobiologist, says. Our experience with sound really does shape us. In fact, she has written an entire book on that topic called Of Sound Mind. The brain processes auditory input faster than visual input. And when we have the space to listen, our brains prioritize what we tune into and reward paying attention through a release of dopamine. From silence to cacophony, here's how your brain makes sense of the world. For example, if you're a teenager excited to be learning with the guitar, musical tones will get preferential treatment. If you're learning to play basketball, the bouncing of the dribbling ball and your coach calling out plays will get your attention. There are certain sounds, like the sound of your own name, that your brain is unconsciously conditioned to respond to, even when you're asleep. But when sounds are out of control and not important to us, they shift into the category of noise. A neighbor's dog barking at a squirrel, a faulty car alarm, the drone of a highway. When the sounds we are exposed to aren't helping us learn a new skill or stay safe at a busy intersection, the brain can get distracted and have problems focusing. It takes brain power to ignore sound. When the world was a lot quieter, our brains paid attention to every little leaf rustle or snap of a twig as a survival tool, Krauss explains. And when our brains are processing sounds that trigger questions like, am I in trouble here or can I ignore this, there's less room to focus on the task in front of us. Consider a modern equivalent. When you're listening to someone tell you something and your phone rings, ding, is that important? You just lost track of where you were. Your brain has to work overtime to ignore sounds. Inside the cochlea, the spiral cavity in the inner ear that produces nerve impulses in response to sound vibrations, there are inner hair cells and outer hair cells that interact to amplify or de-amplify the vibrations. Say you're listening to a piece of music on the radio, but traffic noise is in the background. Krauss says your brain will tell the outer hair cells to slow down and de-amplify the traffic noise to protect your ears. So when there is even just a moderate level of background noise, like traffic or a truck idling, our brains process more slowly. Krauss uses the analogies of a DJ sitting at a mixing board in your brain, assessing and adjusting sounds that come in all day. The more that DJ has to do, the less operating power is available for your brain, making it harder to process new information. It can become physically exhausting as well. People who have trouble hearing often experience listening fatigue. Noise is especially distracting to young brains. We can close our eyes, we can avert our gaze, but we hear in 360 degrees, said Emily Elliott, a psychology professor at Louisiana State University who studies memory and cognition and is one of the authors of a study about how auditory distraction affects a young child's ability to perform serial recall tasks. Elliott and her colleagues devised a test in which they gave young children a visual task of memorizing a series of items on a screen. Then they told the children that sounds would be playing, but not to pay attention to them because they weren't relevant. In general, performance goes down when you're asked to remember a series of things in order in the presence of irrelevant or distracting auditory stimuli. So that tells us the sound is somehow being processed in the cognitive system because you can't just willfully go, I'm not going to listen. Elliott and her team found that the critical ingredients of distraction is sound that changes in some noticeable way. It could be music with lyrics, she says. Music with lyrics is more distracting than music without lyrics. They also found that children under age 7 in particular are bad at memorization because their brains are not yet able to employ a key tactic known as rehearsal. That's where you repeat things to yourself to remember them. And not only will they not remember a list of things, but they're also not aware that they won't remember them. So when you're giving a young child directions or teaching a new topic and a distracting noise is present, the odds of the child remembering any of what you told the child are pretty low. One study of New York City school children in the 1970s found that students in classrooms next to a noisy elevated train track performed significantly poorer on reading tests than their peers on the other side of the building. After the study was published, the city took steps to soundproof the classrooms and minimize the noise coming from the tracks. And a year later, the students' test scores were the same on both sides of the building. In another study by neurologist Krauss and her team, they mapped the brain activity of 66 ninth graders in Chicago public schools while asking them to perform reading and memory tests. Then they monitored the children's electrical brain activity while watching a movie and listening to disruptive sounds. They found that the students who grew up under circumstances associated with noisier environments performed poorer on the reading and memory tasks than those students had what she called noisier brains, meaning a lot of neurons were firing all the time, even when the brain wasn't engaged in a task. You can think of that excess electrical activity as static. And if there's too much static, it makes hard to make sense of all the information you want to be processing. According to Krauss, more static in a child's brain means it's harder for that child to listen and stay focused wherever they are. How silence and some types of noise can benefit children. Krauss believes silence can be of a benefit to children. When she and her team monitored kids with noisy brains under scalp electrodes, they found that periods of silence helped lessen the static. Her team also found that making meaningful sounds, like playing a musical instrument or singing, builds and strengthens neural connections. Other researchers found that pure silence can be healing. In one study on mice, scientists tracked brain cell growth among mice that were exposed to white noise, mice pup sounds, classical music, and ambient sounds, and they were compared those mice with mice that were left in silence. The mice that were left in silence had the most significant brain cell growth, leading researchers to conclude that the act of listening to silence regenerates nerve cells. But absolute silence is rare outside a controlled lab environment. Even in the middle of the woods, you'll hear natural sounds of a bird song, the running water of a stream, leaves rustling, and insects buzzing. These types of sounds could be described as noise, but they are calming to us. And if we try, we can find and recreate these natural sound environments in the middle of a city. In addition to being a researcher, Elliott, the psychology professor, is also a mother of three. She learned early on as a parent to put white noise machines in her kids' bedrooms so that if one of them woke up screaming in the middle of the night, they didn't all wake up. White noise is fascinating because it masks a lot of variability in sound, she said. It takes out some of the frequency ranges and presents something that sounds like a continuous steady sound. In other words, it mimics running water in a stream, and our brains can tune it out. This type of noise becomes a benefit in this situation because it's masking the variability of other sounds that could be a distraction. Get cozy with the sounds of silence. Creating enough quiet to help hear meaningful sound is easier than done. Easier said than done. Some blame, in part, a culture that promotes constant stimulus. There is some expectation that you need to be loud and flashy to capture your child's attention. Everything has to be a fun fair, says Ellen Doherty, chief creative officer for Fred Rogers Productions. That's the company that inherited the mantle of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the children's television program developed in the 60s, known for its calm and reassuring tone. It's still producing media for children, including Doherty's series of shorts, Through the Woods, which is deliberately quiet. The three-minute shorts is about a kid walking through the woods, wondering, observing, and experiencing. Instead of background music, you hear birds chirping, the wind blowing, and leaves rustling. The sound designers do a believable job of making viewers feel like they are in the woods. But Doherty says this kind of programming goes against the grain of expectations. We take our shows to focus groups and ask parents, would your children watch this, Doherty says. And so often, parents say to us that it's not bright and flashy, my kids won't watch it. Doherty calls this type of show the fun fair. She believes you can have good shows with music and bright colors that aren't distracting, but actually work to teach learning skills such as how to manage emotions or calm yourself down. My metric is, does this need to exist? I think we need to be able to honor silence, Krauss says, and there's something almost mystical there. You know, may we have a moment of silence. It's really a good time to get into yourself. Using Doherty's question, does this need to exist, as a guide, we might begin to think of silence as a chance to learn and look forward to making our lives quieter. And I was really kind of, a number of years ago, there was a Latin American poet who said that the way he decides about whether he actually keeps a poem that he's written is, can it improve upon silence, which I thought was a beautiful thing. It sort of relates tangentially to this topic. There is actually a set of specific things you can do, tips for parents, creating a quiet environment for kids, and I'll give you those. There are a lot of ways to create a quiet environment for kids. Limiting audible distractions during important learning moments, even very early attempts to make words, will help children increase their capacity to focus. If it's homework time, a no TV rule is a no-brainer. Turn off phone notifications. Be aware of not just sound, but timing. One child's oboe practice time is another kid's reading nightmare. Use white noise machines at bedtime or reading time to cut out some frequencies of otherwise distracting sounds. Soundproofing a bedroom with carpet, heavy curtains, and tapestries can muffle outside noises. Visit a park or library if you can't find quiet at home. Okay, well, that brings us to the last regular feature of the show, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. I have 22 bonus stories this week. First up, causal association found between evening social media use and delayed sleep. Sort of a follow-up to the whole sound story, that the distraction caused by social media and the blue light that we get and the expectation of a response to our postings delays sleep in a real-life study. Bonus article 2. Why scientists have a hard time getting money to study the root causes of outbreaks. So this is really just a good background story on how we're don't really value prevention. It's not that sexy or exciting. It also involves longer-term boring data collection, which a lot of funders, you know, want the new novel thing and always want to keep moving to something new rather than funding long-term projects that collect basic data. And bonus article 3 sort of relates to this. Our U.S. nutrition monitoring system is at grave risk. Actually, that major monitoring system, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, was cited in an earlier story that I reported. Well, this system has been underfunded as no funding increases. It has a very complex system where it does a representative sample of the entire country, both surveys and blood samples and all kinds of things. But this is being ever degraded. And if we lose that, you're not going to be able to do all this other analysis. You need basic data. And in public health, that's one of the three core functions, assessment. The other two are policy development and lastly assurance, covering services that cannot be delivered in another way in our society. Okay, next up, a few stories of things not working too well. Bonus article 4, in the wild west of outpatient vascular care, doctors can reap huge payments as patients risk life and limb. So this is just one example of where for-profit healthcare really distorts the mission of actually making people healthier. And this is actually something that has been proven not to work very well. A lot of this this particular type of vascular care that was in recent years has been approved for payment is overused by a lot of doctors. And they can make a ton of money, but they also are doing something that's not only not helpful, but can actually be dangerous for patients. Bonus Article 5, DEA's failure to punish distributor blamed in opioid crisis raises revolving door questions. So this is where a consultant who worked on a company not getting punishment ends up actually getting a top spot, one of the top spots in the DEA. And it's just an example of this kind of revolving door corruption between business and that public health government sector that we need to get a little bit more accountability. And a similar note, bonus article 6, how doctors buy their way out of trouble. A lot of times money by paying fines and stuff, you can have people who've committed fraud or malpractice continue actually in the practice of healthcare by basically buying their way out of it. But a little bit of the solution, there's a clue here from bonus article 7, why are female doctors sued nearly half as often as male doctors? This gets at the fact that we need to get rid of some patriarchy in our healthcare system and world as a whole. And this is an example where female doctors do practice differently than male doctors. And it actually, by listening more, by doing a better assessment and actually talking to their patients more, finds that it, if anything, it produces more patient satisfaction. And that's probably, putting it mildly, it'd be much better for the system. We need to feminize and depatriarchalize our medical system. And getting at that a little bit, the next story, bonus article 8, checklists to screen for patients' social needs aren't helping. So this is advancement that we're considering social needs, social determinants, but just doing a checklist without actually listening to individual patients, what their needs are, and making specific, meaningful referrals to people, it often doesn't do any good. It's simply, part of it's just the amount you're willing to invest, time and energy and coordination, which often doesn't happen. You know, just add another checklist. And this is also something that this quest for efficiency and the whole push for like AI and stuff, you know, oftentimes really takes out the human element, which is a big part of the healing that happens in the healthcare sector. Bonus article 9, a mental health crisis is gripping science. A toxic research culture is to blame. So this is both sexism, patriarchy, but also just toxic research culture is a lot of, you know, publisher perish, the shadows of capitalism reaching in and making science not work well, need to make a healthy work environment to create healthy science in a healthy world. Bonus article 10, denials of health insurance claims are rising and getting weirder. So with the rise, particularly of Medicare Advantage, they're using algorithms and AI, hiring denial nurses whose sole job is basically to deny claims. And you put denial in their title. Basically, you know, when you refer them to that way, you know what they're about. It's making health and health claims not happen. And because partly this algorithmic, these refusals are getting weirder, and only a small proportion of those claims are ever actually challenged. So it's a huge way of making money and denying care, is just refuse to pay, and most people aren't able or willing to resist. Bonus article 11. Hundreds of thousands have lost Medicaid coverage since pandemic protections expired, a lot for procedural reasons. So this is, we're getting early data about what we feared was going to happen, which was that when people are having to be re-enrolled, that just the bureaucracy itself is going to result in a lot of people not getting care, not whether they actually are eligible for the benefit or not. Bonus Article 12, a catch-22 for clinics. State bans limit abortion counseling. Federal Title 10 rules require it. I'd actually say this is more than a catch-22. It's a real conundrum, conflict here. You got two different conflicting requirements. The federal Title 10 requires comprehensive care, which includes referrals and information on abortion, and some states are banning that. So you've got a state requirement that's conflicting with a federal requirement. Bonus Article 13, Texas wants to wean trans youth off meds in a, quote, safe and medically appropriate way. Doctors say that's impossible. So this is the problem with having legislators trying to do medicine, is they don't know what they're doing. And basically doctors are saying there really is no safe and medically appropriate way to wean trans youth off these meds. In a sort of related article, bonus article 14, gender-affirming hormone therapy reduces psychological stress in transgender people, says Systematic Review. Now, having that in conjunction with the last story, I just want to clarify that when they say gender-affirming hormone therapy, that doesn't necessarily, they were not looking at like puberty blockers, but they looked at gender-affirming hormone therapy among a wide ranges. And this is basically to take hormones to make your body look more like the gender you identify with. And that definitely reduces psychological distress. Bonus Article 15, a lifetime of racism makes Alzheimer's more common in Black Americans. So people over age 65, Black Americans are 40% more likely to have Alzheimer's. Bonus Article 16, new study indicates treatment patterns, not genetics, drive prostate cancer disparities. So, you know, there's a lot of thought. It's basically medical racism. The history of just kind of default thinking that if there's health disparities, that's because Black Americans are different than white Americans in some genetic way. That is really not true. There are very limited things genetic that are associated with race. I mean, just the genetic differences that why there's rare diseases and stuff, because there's genetic differences in different populations. But when you're looking wholesale, these things are driven by social disparities, not biological differences. And along those lines, bonus article 17, Black children are more likely to have asthma. A lot comes down to where they live. This is a follow-up second in a series of story I've reported before, that the social determinants of where you live has a lot to do, in this case, with asthma, your environment. 18, what is long COVID? For the first time, a new study defines it with 12 defining conditions. If you or someone you love has long COVID or wondering about whether you have long COVID, this gets at, it has a little point system about what's the most defining conditions for long COVID. 19, worse than what we thought, new data reveals deeper problems in the Bureau of Prisons' COVID response. Yikes. Yep, even worse than we thought. Prisons are not a good place for your health. Bonus Article 20, how Supreme Court EPA's ruling will massively affect U.S. wetlands and clean water. Of course, the environment is a public health issue, and this new EPA ruling that will basically redefine up to half of U.S. wetlands as not wetlands, and not subject to the Clean Water Act, is going to be a real problem. Article 21, plastic waste puts more than 200 million of world's poorest at higher risk from floods, as plastic pollution blocks drainage systems. We're literally drowning in plastic, and it's blocking drainage systems around the world. Bonus Article 22, last but not least, how the arts can benefit your mental health. No talent required. Drawing, music, and writing can elevate your mood. Here are some easy ways to welcome them into your life. A good read if you're interested in that. And I can personally attest, I use writing poetry as a way of therapy, and I highly recommend whichever one works better for you, drawing, music, and writing, or more than one. You can view these and any other articles that have reported on in this show, this episode, or previous ones by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.